Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend's edition. On this weekend show, we're going to be very much focusing on investing in the resource sector, especially in the first half of the show as we're chatting with a well-known fund manager that will break down more of his fund's performance and some of the key stories that have caught investors' interest throughout the at least early part of this year. Back half of the show, we'll touch a little bit on markets, but also cycle, of course, back around to the resource sector. Just as a reminder, please go back through our website, kereport.com, or podcast. Just search the KE Report in your podcast player to listen to all our daily editorials covering some wild market moves this week, especially in the AI space, on the back of that DeepSeek news, as well as recapping Fed meeting and a lot of tech earnings, as well as company updates. It was another busy week for all of us. And hey, I thank you all for listening, taking some time on your weekend to listen to the weekend show. To kick off the show, we are chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. If you want to learn more about Matt's fund and follow along with his shareholder letters, just click the link in the show notes. Matt, let's just first recap 2024 in terms of the MJG Capital's portfolio, your fund. What was the performance like last year?
Well, happy New Year's, guys. If it's not too late to say that, good to be with you. Look, I would characterize 2024 as an incredibly frustrating year, really, really across the board for mining investors. I'd say the year was defined by very strong price performance, at least by the two key bellwether metals, which I would say are copper and gold. Gold ended up the year 27%. Sterling performance, best that we've seen since 2010 in terms of annualized performance for gold. Copper, though, did fade pretty hard into year end, still ended 2024 up 8%. And for large portions of the year, pricing was extremely strong. I mean, we saw an all-time high reached for copper around 520 a pound. That was in the spring. Even as recently as early October, we saw copper prices at, you know, 460, 470 per pound. So two key metals did really well. The mining equities, on the other hand, really struggled to keep pace, let alone provide leverage to these two key metals. You know, the biggest producers, especially on the precious metal front, did start to perk up, you know, late spring and into the summer, but really at best were keeping pace with the move that we saw in the gold price. And the juniors, which, you know, really is the sandbox in which the MJG partnership plays, were basically neglected for at least the first 9 months of the year. We did have a period, though, starting in late September, lasting through the fourth week of October, so we'll say a 4 or 5 week period, where it really did look like the juniors were breaking out and finally responding to these metal price moves, as well as the, you know, somewhat muted but still, you know, distinct price moves amongst larger producers. You know, the fund, you know, was up maybe low double digits, you know, low teens, kind of the mid to late October timeframe, before really moving over that 4 to 5 week period. You know, come that fourth week of October, we were up over 30% year to date. And it was really getting exciting. This was, you know, it was looking like the breakout that we'd been waiting many months to see. But then, of course, it turned on its head, basically to the day when Newmont came out with its disastrous earnings report. That was Thursday, October 24th. That day is embedded in my memory. And then that was followed on about a week and a half later by Trump's reelection to his second term, and the resulting strength in the U.S. dollar, as well as, you know, I'd argue tariff concerns and how that would affect China, which as we know is the major consumer of basically all commodities across the board, and that led to what I would describe as Chinese water torture over the final 2 months of the year, November and December, just watching the portfolio draw down day by day. And we went from that, you know, up over 30% year to date, finished the year up, you know, 6.8%. So it was really frustrating. You know, and that price action was seen really across the whole mining complex. You know, I note this in the latest MJG investor letter, but we saw the GDX drop from its late October high. It was up 43% year to date into that fourth week of October. It ended the year up 9%. The GDXJ was doing even better in that late October timeframe, up 47% year to date, ended the year up 13%. The COPEX, which is an ETF comprised of the world's largest copper producers, earlier in October, but in that October timeframe, was up as much as 30% year to date, ended up the year just positive at plus 2% year to date. So there really was pain across the board from the largest of the producers to the smallest of the junior explorers. And I would just make one final point. You know, if I had gazed into a crystal ball right at the start of 2024, and I'd seen clearly that A, the price of gold would have its best year to annual performance since 2010, and B, we would see a flurry of mining M&A to the extent that we did, you know, not seen in over a decade. You know, were those two things to play out simultaneously as they did in 2024, I would have thought that the MJG portfolio would be up closer to 113%, which was the return we posted in 2020. So the fact that we had a, you know, lackluster single digit return on the year was frustrating and in some ways puzzling as well.
Well, Matt, just thinking about that, when you look at most financial institutions, they report quarterly numbers and annual numbers. And it's natural to look at, okay, January 1st to December 31st, how did a fund do? But the reality is most people, when they're buying and selling stocks or ETFs or any equities, are not doing it on the very beginning of the year and selling at the end of the year. So those periods of time, like the September-October rush or copper stocks mid-year or some of the periods of time where the gold and silver stocks did run, you know, I think there was periods of a whipsaw motion, but a lot of people that are listening to this, you know, probably had the same experience where there was periods of time where they had some good trades, or maybe they rang the register on some good trades, but the end of the year entering on a down note, entering with a whimper from November, December, is really what took the steam and the sentiment down in the sector. As a fund manager, do you look at that as far as when to exit positions or when to trim positions, when to add to positions? Because those are not done at the beginning of the year or at the end of the year. Those are done during the year.
You make a great point. No, I don't. Many fund managers do, and I am sympathetic to them. But I've structured the MJG fund in a way where all investors, and it's an open-ended fund, so new investors are joining, but from the date of first investment, all investors commit to a 10-year lockup. So while it's more difficult to raise money that way, naturally, I've structured it in a way where I can think over longer time frames, and I'm not beholden to quarterly or even annual results. And I think that type of thinking is certainly detrimental to long-term investment returns. I understand why, if you could see redemptions on a minute's notice, that would be something that's factoring into your decision-making. But I've structured this in a way where that's simply not. But, you know, your point is still well taken. Like, if the year had ended at the end of October, this would be, you know, a very different call summarizing the year's result. And it's, you know, hard not to get a little carried away. You know, I was really looking forward in that late October timeframe to reporting, you know, strong results to our patient limited partners, you know, raising some significant money off the back of that. But yeah, that simply did not come to pass. And I would put Newmont and Mr. Trump kind of as the two culprits for that real slide we saw in the final 60 days of the year.
Matt, let's talk about that comment you made where in past years, past cycles, you would have expected the fund to be up well over 100% and show that leverage to the metals price. The problem being, we've heard this argument, I feel like, for a number of years now. And you even look at something like the GDX, which continues to put in arguably lower highs as gold continues to spike to higher and higher levels. It's just not following that same playbook. And this has been over a decade long now. Do we need to understand that maybe this market has shifted and the stocks broadly don't have that kind of leverage, which is why it's so important to be, I guess, a stock picker? Or if you really do like simply the gold narrative, stick to investing in gold and not necessarily the gold stocks?
Well, I still hold the belief that over periods of sustained outperformance in the gold price, or really in any metal price, that the producers and the developers and ultimately the explorers of said metal will provide leverage to said price move. It could be different this time. It could be. I do not think that's the case. You know, another potential explanation here is that there's some major catch up to be done across the gold space generally. That's the camp that I fall into. It's obviously this dislocation that we've seen is wider than perhaps ever, but certainly in our investment lifetimes, between, at least if you look at the gold space, the price of the physical metal and the mining equities themselves. I view that as an opportunity. So first option is it's different this time. Second is that there's major catch up to be played. I guess the third potential outcome is that mining equities or the precious metal equities are sniffing out a decline in the gold price. And maybe a year from now, we see gold at, you know, $1,800 an ounce. I think that's quite unlikely as well. So I'm firmly in the second camp. I think the third camp is maybe, you know, is a possibility. I think it being different this time and for gold to just continue to run with the metal prices not playing catch up is the least likely of those three scenarios outlined.
Well, Matt, let's dive into some of the ways that you analyze companies when you are the chief stock picker for the MJG Capital Fund. I know that you like to get into stocks early when you appreciate their management team, the project. There's a lot of factors you look at besides just the price action of the underlying commodity. In fact, you've mentioned on our show, that's often one of the last things you look at. But the other thing is when you're getting into these, you're often entering through a private placement. And you have just summarized to your audience a lot of these different things that you look for that are red flags and yellow flags in private placements. For those that like to access the markets that way and get into some of these, what can you tell us are some of the big things that you try to avoid in these, or maybe the red flags that you try to steer clear of?
Well, that's right. And I included a piece in the latest MJG investor letter, you know, discussing this very point. I went back and counted, and we've participated in over 90 different private placements since the fund's inception. So this is certainly a means of initiating a position that I'm quite comfortable with. And of the current 17 holdings within the portfolio, 11 of them were at least initiated through a private placement. And then in many cases, there was open market buying, you know, after that. But I did create this list of 15 different, I would describe as yellow flags for investors to look out for when evaluating whether to participate in a given placement. I will say I took great pains to emphasize that before you even look at these 15 points, you need to make sure the investment checks the same boxes that you would look for as if you're buying the company on the open market. So there's not a huge difference in terms of what you need to see. And you mentioned a few of those: the people, the project, a serviceable financial structure, upcoming catalysts to drive value with the company well-financed to achieve those catalysts, a price that is below either expected or fair value, depending on the stage of the company, and an investable commodity and jurisdiction that both makes sense on an absolute basis, but also within the context of your existing portfolio. So you always want to start there. And I think it's easy, and I made this mistake earlier in my career, to get tempted by private placements that had incredibly rich terms from an investment perspective. You know, the full five-year placement with no accelerator is kind of the gold standard for the best that you could expect to receive as an investor. But if the company does not check these seven boxes that I've just run through, then even the greatest terms, it's not worthy of participation. With that said, even in investments where those boxes are checked, you know, I highlighted 15 different circumstances that should cause investors pause, if not outright rejection of a given private placement. And these 15 circumstances fall into one of four different categories. One is the other participants that are taking place in the deal, whether that's board and management, whether that's, you know, major existing shareholders, and whether that's new shareholders, which ideally aren't either warrant clippers or engaging in a check swap with the company. Second category is pricing, kind of how the deal is priced relative to past private placements, how it's priced relative to the most recent option grant, and how it's priced relative to recent promotion done by the company. So pricing is that second category. The third is the timing of the deal, including its, you know, proximity to previous private placements, its timing in relation to escrow periods lifting, its timing relative to the expiration of in the money warrants. and also its timing relative to expected share price catalysts. And then the final bucket is kind of use of proceeds. Where are the proceeds of the financing going to be spent? And so that's how I break it down. I don't think we need to go through each of them one by one, but I would also state that, you know, I did a write-up roughly a year ago that was in the January 2024 investor letter about 25 red flags to avoid for management teams, basically 25 deal breakers that should cause one to look elsewhere when evaluating a management team. I would argue that the vast majority of these, while they should cause an investor to be extremely wary, there is room for some nuance. So important to keep in mind, but you know, in the case of a CEO with double digit ownership and the, you know, vast majority of his or her net worth already invested in a company, you know, it may be okay to participate in a deal, you know, even if that CEO is not taking a piece for themselves. Or in the case of a financing where there's, you know, the expiration of deeply in the money warrants, you know, within the next 4 months, if the number of warrants is, you know, utterly inconsequential relative to the company's total share count and average trading volume, perhaps that can be overlooked. Or, you know, one of the circumstances mentioned is a keep the lights on financing, you know, to avoid financings where the company isn't raising enough capital to answer at least one significant unanswered question. You know, in the case where the company is an optionality play, which is not a typical investment for the MJG partnership, but just as an example of an edge case, you know, where the whole premise of the optionality business model is to do, in essence, do nothing other than keeping the lights on, you know, that can be overlooked. So I want to emphasize that nuance can be applied to these points, and very few of them are flat out deal breakers in, you know, in their own right.
Matt, I want to put a situation in front of you too when it comes to a financing. A company that, let's say the share price has done fairly well, it seems to have stabilized at a generally, let's say, higher level. And then they issue a news release that says they're raising money at a discount to market, a fairly significant discount to market with a warrant. You see the stock price drop right when that news comes out to that financing price. How do you evaluate those type of financings when they are done at a discount to market when the share price seems like it had stabilized higher?
I think one question you should ask before we get into this hypothetical is, why did the share price re-rate in the first place? And if the share price re-rated off of the back of heavy promotion and no fundamental, you know, company specific catalyst to actually justify the move, one should be a lot more skeptical about the raise, you know, irrespective of how big the discount is or what the terms are on the deal. You know, in your hypothetical, assuming that the share price move was justified by a real catalyst, maybe it was a drill program, maybe it was an update to a resource, maybe it was a PE or a significant permitting milestone, then I'd be more receptive to participating in said deal. And then the other question I'd ask is, well, you know, is the company raising at this discount and with the warrant because they don't have access to capital at the 50-cent level? Or is it a sweetheart round for insiders and for existing shareholders? So I think that should also be questioned. And of course, you know, all deals are different, all have specific circumstances. So if I were looking at this, I would see who's participating. And in many cases, when there's a sweetheart deal, there's not room for outsiders to come in. And, you know, that kind of makes your decision right there on whether you want to participate or not. If you own common shares of the company and see a sweetheart deal where a company is raising at a discount with a warrant that seems unjustified or, you know, overly generous to new investors at the current share price, then one should certainly reexamine their decision to hold that company to begin with. So I think there's so many different variables. I don't know if you want to flesh out that hypothetical anymore, but those are a few of the thoughts that immediately come to mind.
Well, Matt, you mentioned there was 15 yellow flags, but off mic, you mentioned there was definitely two red flags that would cause you to say a hard stop, probably not interested. Maybe just cover those since those are easier for people to digest, get their head around.
Sure. Well, yeah, the two big ones would be a financing being conducted less than 4 months after the close of a previous financing. Particularly if that financing is at a premium to the previous financing, particularly if it includes worse warrant terms. But really, in any circumstance, even with really sticky investors, you're going to see a decent amount of selling pressure when that 4 month and 1 day hold period lifts. And this pertains to Canadian markets, not the Aussie markets, to be clear. But you're putting yourself in a position to be exploited, in essence, by the participants in the previous placement. If you're putting money into a deal that is priced before that 4 month and 1 day hold period lifts. So if you're in that position, even if it's a financing that you are excited about, you really like the team, the project, the company structure, I would stress to management, let's hold off for this 4 month and 1 day period to pass. Let's see where the share price settles. And then at that point, I'd be happy to participate. And if they're unwilling to do that and they plow forward with doing the financing otherwise, then perhaps it's best to look elsewhere. So that's one clear example. The second one is also very important. And this is when you see a financing that is conducted just before a significant share price catalyst is expected, a share price catalyst that the company is already sufficiently funded for. So, you know, such a catalyst could be a significant drill program at the company's flagship project. It could be an updated resource or a maiden resource. It could be a key permitting outcome. It could be a PEA, you know, the first look at the project's economics, a whole host of different catalysts. You know, in the hypothetical, you know, said company is coming out with one of these catalysts in mid-2025, say June 2025, and they're well cashed up to achieve that catalyst. But 30 days or so before said catalyst is expected, the company comes out and says, we're raising a boatload of money. That should say clearly to you as an investor that bad news is in the offing. Otherwise, if this management team was acting in the best interests of shareholders and they had good news to report to the market, you know, in just 3, 4, 5 weeks away, they, of course, would hold off on doing the deal, wait to announce that news, and then raise on the back of the share price rate that one would expect to see on the back of that news. So I think it's important to, when you're evaluating a placement, look at it in the context of stated catalysts that the company had said previously. And if it's occurring, you know, when there's a catalyst in the very near future, that's a clear sign that there is bad news that is coming down the pike.
All good points there, Matt. And you know what? For those that can get into private placements, that's your chance to really talk to management and hash out a lot of these details. Plus, a lot of the shareholders and stuff you can find online too, diving into, especially that SEDAR website. Let's talk a couple stocks that have been getting some attention. One that you're bringing to our attention is Corex Copper. This is traded KRY on the TSX Venture Exchange. The company's project is in Namibia. Look, this project has a lot of history behind it. Major companies have been on this project, including Rio Tinto, Teck. There is a current resource, maybe a bit of a lower grade resource, I think right around 0.35% copper. But this year, the company has a big drill program planned, I believe right around 55,000 meters. They're going after it hard. Right now, this market cap of the company, right around $80 million Canadian. Break down how you view Corex Copper, the good and the bad here, Matt.
Be happy to. Corex was the featured investment in the latest MJG investor letter. I did a good 12 or 13 page write-up on the company. For anybody interested in reading through that, it's on the MJG website at mjgcapital.com. And Corex is also our most recently initiated position. That was all the way back in June 2024. So if you can believe it, it's been 7 months since we've added a new name to the portfolio. And Corex was that name. Look, I think it's a pretty simple investment to understand. The thing that attracted me to the story, really full stop, was the people involved. It's Haya and his partner, Alan Friedman. These are two gentlemen that have had multiple successes in Namibia, which is where Corex's flagship Habe copper project is located. And just in the past 12 years, they've sold two different companies for a total of, you know, 550-odd million Canadian, one to a Western buyer, one to a Chinese buyer. And of course, the most recent one was Osino, which saw that deal close just in Q3 of 2024. I think it was less than 3 trading days later, Haya was formally introduced to the Corex story as the executive chairman. And, you know, this team has a history of taking later stage projects and optimizing the engineering, pushing through permitting, getting them to a point where they're ready to be built, and then selling them on to larger parties to take the project forward. And they're looking to repeat that blueprint right here with CoreX. You know, as you mentioned, it's a project that's already seen significant amount of work over many decades, starting in the 1970s. So they have a huge amount of drilling data and previous engineering work to piggyback off of. And they have a very ambitious timeline. Their goal is to get this thing fully permitted and get a feasibility study out in late 2026. They just raised a significant sum of capital at $1.10 Canadian with no warrants. So that speaks to the access to capital that this group has. They'll probably need to do one more financing before they can get through that feasibility study. But they're really off to the races between drilling, metallurgical work. We'll see potentially two different economic studies announced this year, followed by a feasibility study in late 2026. And, you know, the real thesis here is simple. You note the deposit has a low grade, 0.35% copper. That number's likely to rise closer to 0.42% copper equivalent once moly and gold byproducts are reflected in the resource grade. But even for an open pit project, it's definitely not a high grade deposit by any means, but it has a whole lot more going for it. Despite being already very advanced, it's close to infrastructure, power, roads, very importantly, water. It's located at a low altitude. There's not going to be difficulty bringing in labor. This is not a fly-in, fly-out situation by any means. So they can push this forward quickly and relatively efficiently, particularly compared to, you know, say a project in the high Andes or, you know, deep in the Democratic Republic of Congo. As mentioned, it's a jurisdiction that they know well, a mining ministry that they've worked with very closely for many years. They think a permit can be in hand by the end of 2026. And their goal here is to prove to the market and to address the skepticism that this project is too low of grade to make sense at current metal prices. Haya is convinced, and his team is convinced, that Habe can work, you know, in the current copper price environment, you know, say $4 to $4.50 per pound copper. Obviously, if copper runs to $6 or $8 per pound, that would be gravy. But that's not the MJG investment style by any means. Though I should note that due to the size and the relatively low grade of this deposit, you'd see pretty exceptional leverage for a project of the type of Habe. But nonetheless, Haya is convinced that it works at current metal prices, and he will look to prove that over the course of the upcoming updated PEA, pre-feas, and feasibility study in late 2026, at which point the company would likely seriously consider selling it to a larger producer to take forward. And Namibia is friendly to both Western and Chinese interests, you know, most recently evidenced by Osino's sale to Shanjin Gold out of China. So I think if the team can execute on its goals, and past history suggests that they do execute on their goals, they can get into position within 24 months here to monetize it at a significant premium to the current share price. And I'll just end quickly. If you look at multiples paid in major copper transactions dating back to 2021, even if you take the very lowest PNAV multiple at which a transaction was taken place, I would argue that there's potential for 3x upside from the current share price, even factoring in the additional dilution that will be needed to take this through feasibility. So I think even though the share price has admittedly re-rated pretty sharply since the involvement of the Sino team, I think there's plenty of meat left on the bone for investors that believe in this group executing.
Well, Matt, I appreciate you breaking down the value proposition that you see in CoreX Copper. And yeah, a pretty infamous team, especially when we were all at Beaver Creek. That was the talk of the town because they had just sold Osino and were just shifting into CoreX Copper. And while we're talking about copper and gold, the talk of the town at the Metals Investor Forum and the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference that we just attended in Vancouver was A-Mark Resources, another copper and gold stock that's gotten people's attention. Wanted to get you to weigh in on it. At the current place, it's still early days, and this is a JV that A-Mark has with Freeport, the large major metals producer, and they had some pretty exciting copper gold results that hit the market. It's really gotten people's fascination. So again, this is the talk of the town at the latest conference season. What's your take on the results that we've seen come out of A-Mark Resources?
Sure. I mean, it's definitely captured the attention of the junior mining space. We have no financial interest one way or another in this discovery. I do think it's very exciting. I mean, it's rare to see widths at those grades, particularly very near surface. A lot of these intercepts that we've seen are starting less than 100 meters below surface. So I think the excitement is justified. As you mentioned, this has already been relatively well covered by other parties, but kind of a few points that come to mind for me. The first, I would say, this is more of a gold discovery than anything. AMARC is certainly taking pains to brand it as a copper discovery, but if you look at the intercepts, you know, really a good 25 to 35% of the value is copper, with the rest being gold. So we can say 70% of the metal value appears to be gold. Perhaps AMARC is playing to the market, you know, thinking that the market would more embrace a brand new copper discovery in BC versus gold, or perhaps they're catering to their partner Freeport, who clearly is more copper focused than anything. So that's one point I would note. A second is, you know, the interesting dynamics in terms of Freeport's decision making going forward here. Interesting deal in that Freeport has the option to earn a 60% stake in the project by spending $35 million, and then the option to take that up to 70% interest, an additional 10% project level interest, for a full $75 million. So really big sums here at play. Freeport, to my understanding, has already spent $34 million. So they are $1 million away from a decision point where they can choose to either spend $75 million over the next 5 years to get to that 70% stake, or if they want to squeeze AMARC, could turn it immediately into a 60-40 contributing JV. My expectation is that they will go for the 70%. You know, for these bigger parties, it often behooves them to play nice with minority partners so that they can do deals with other groups in the future. But there's at least one astute observer within my network who thinks there's a chance that Freeport might convert this to a 60-40 JV when they hit that $35 million mark, you know, in the next few months here. So that's an interesting dynamic to watch. And then the other angle, of course, is TDG Gold, which is right next door. I'm naturally skeptical of area plays, particularly in the Golden Triangle, where, you know, it's a huge country up there, and having a neighboring project can mean absolutely nothing when you're talking about, you know, tens or hundreds of kilometers. But in the case of TDG, this seems to be real. I mean, the discovery hole was a few hundred meters from the property boundary. And while it's yet to be proven, it does seem reasonable to suppose that this, you know, tabular ore body, which, you know, trends from the east to the west and has been defined to date over 600 meters, is likely to trend onto TDG's property. TDG has done drilling near the property boundary, but the depth of those drill holes were only, you know, 200 to 225 meters of depth. And based on the geometry, it's looking, you know, like if the ore body does extend onto the project, that, you know, we'd expect to see it at the 400 to 500 meter depth level. So that's an exciting target for them to test. I think the share price re-rate, TDG has actually done better than AMARC on the back of this discovery from a share price perspective. I think that's well justified, and that's going to be an exciting story to follow going forward. Though, as a word of caution for everybody that's excited about AMARC and TDG, you know, I should note that there is reason to be skeptical of whether this is large enough to be of interest to Freeport. Excellent grades, nice widths of 180 meters, but it does seem like the mineralization drops off almost entirely once you're through that tabular ore body. And I think it would be a lot more interesting if the mineralization continued, even at much lower grades, so that you could get more of a bulk tonnage scenario with a higher grade zone closer to surface. That may be the case. It doesn't seem like we're seeing that yet. And so there is risk that Freeport, you know, goes ahead with their phase two of the earn-in, you know, spending $75 million to go up to 70%, you know, spends 10, 15, 20 million over the next couple years, and kind of comes to the decision internally that this is not Freeport size, or, you know, this doesn't fit in with our company priorities strategically. And it's a long wait. I mean, once the clock starts on that phase two earn-in, let's just assume it starts mid-2025, that takes us all the way to mid-2030. Before they have to make a decision. You know, Freeport could play nice, and, you know, if they decide it's not big enough for them, Maybe they could vend their project level interest into A-Mark in exchange for shares and let A-Mark run with it going forward. But there is risk that Freeport spends another year or two, you know, aggressively pursuing this and then, you know, hesitates on whether it's big enough. You know, that would leave A-Mark in a lurch. TDG owns their project 100%, so they can continue to push forward, but that could delay any ultimate consolidation of the district, you know, longer than folks maybe would hope. So those are all thoughts pinging around my head in terms of this discovery. But certainly exciting, certainly good news for the space.
Absolutely. We saw the share price react, and we also saw some other companies, as you said, in the area. Still early stage, but I'm glad you did touch on that area, that Tutagon area, because it has come back into light right beside the Golden Triangle. We'll see if more activity happens there, because it has been relatively active over the last few years. All right, Matt, we're wrapping it up here. So again, Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Make sure you click that link in the show notes to learn more about Matt's fund and MJG Capital broadly. Matt, thank you so much for taking time with us on this weekend show. Everyone, stick around. We are going to be right back.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.